And hello, everyone, and thank you for joining the Electronic Prior Authorization RFI Task Force. I'm Mike Berry with ONC, and we are very happy that you could be with us again today. As a reminder, your feedback is always welcome, which can be typed in the chat feature to everyone throughout the meeting, or can be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled at approximately 11:20 Eastern Time this morning. So I'm going to begin with roll call of our task force members. So when I call your name, please indicate that you are here. And I'll start with our co-chairs. Cheryl Turney.
Cheryl's here.
Tammy Banks.
Here.
Hans Wittendyke.
Present.
Dave DeGondi. Raj Gotabarty.
I'm here.
Jim Georges.
Present.
Rich Landon.
I'm here.
Heather McComas.
Good morning, here.
Aaron Neary. Patrick Murda.
Here.
Eliel Oliveira.
Eliel is here.
Deborah Strickland. All right, well, thank you everyone. And now please join me in welcoming Cheryl and Tammy for their opening remarks.
Wonderful. I think before we get started, we'd like to have a couple of our new task force members introduce themselves. I think Patrick actually joined the last meeting, but didn't get that opportunity. And also Dave. So Dave, can you go first? And then we'll go to Patrick. Maybe David's on mute. All right, why don't we go to Patrick?
Yeah, thank you, Cheryl. So Patrick Murda with Humana. I am our chief interoperability architect and represent the organization in a lot of our industry work. So glad to be here. Thank you for the invite.
Very glad to have you. As you can see, we have a very full agenda today, and we're going to kick it off with a brief overview of the implementation guides that are referenced in the RFI. And we have Viet Nguyen, who's here from HL7 DaVinci to provide that overview. Very happy and thankful that he was able to join us. Also, we're going to have another robust discussion of our working document. And I wanna thank everyone for their thoughtful comments. We've gotten quite a lot of updates to our Google Doc. And so Tammy, once again, will lead us through the review of the comments. And hopefully today we're going to focus on some of the questions that were included in the RFI related to certification requirements, et cetera. Then we have our public comment at 11:20. And then we'll review our homework and next steps. And then we'll adjourn. One point I would like to call out is that we will be providing an update to high tech next week in the high tech meeting on the 15th. And so after today's meeting, Tammy and I will work with ONC and Excel to put together that presentation and make it available to you folks once we've presented it, but basically it's a small progress report in terms of how the subcommittee is doing. Any questions on the agenda or our goals for today? All right, I'm going to turn it over to Tammy if she would like to add anything.
No, just very thankful and appreciative that Viet's here to present and answer questions in regards to the IGs related to prior authorization. So I'm hopeful that you did review section 2 and the questions so that you are able to glean the information that we needed in order to respond to those questions. We do have an option to bring him back. However, always good to take advantage of him while he's here. So again, appreciate it, Viet. And Cheryl, do you want me to just hand it over to Viet or?
Absolutely.
Go ahead. Viet, take it away, appreciate it.
Great, thank you very much for the invitation to present to the task force. So let's go ahead and jump in to the next slide. I just want to briefly thank our DaVinci membership. They really are huge drivers in allowing us to do this important work. They fund our work and provide their in-kind subject matter expertise and have really been participating in the development of these implementation guides. And the important thing here is that there's a wide swath of participation from payers to providers, EHR vendors, our partner organizations. So I just wanted to thank them. So the next slide, please. So I wanted to put the four implementation guides that I'll be discussing into context of the work that DaVinci has been doing over the past 4 years. The burden reduction collection of guides includes the coverage requirements, discovery, documentation, templates and rules, and prior authorization that were identified in the RFI. But I also wanted to highlight that I'll be discussing the clinical data exchange or CDEX guide, which isn't directly referenced in the RFI, but is suitable for discussion around attachments and exchange of clinical data for patient care and administrative purposes. But it's one of the two guides we use to support exchange of clinical data between providers and other providers, as well as payers and providers. Important here to help orient you on this slide, we've updated it to give it a little bit more of flavor in terms of helping understand where our guides are. So at the bottom, there's a legend that you can see three colors, green for most mature, a light blue for active growth, and our kind of tan color for the least mature and under development. So as you look at these, you can see a number of them are already green and most of them are at least the blue color. And then the dial shows that where they are in the current process for updating these guides. As you may be aware, HL7 takes guides and puts them through a public community feedback process called balloting. And a number of these guides have either been through at least one, all of them mostly have been through at least one ballot, and a number of them have gone through a second set of ballots, and a number of them that we're going to talk about today are going to go into ballot in the next month or so for an update. So this recognizing the kind of ongoing journey of standards development, where we develop the guides, we test them, we try to mature them through real world implementations, and then improve them in that feedback loop. So next slide, please. So the first three set of implementation guides that we'll be discussing are the burden reduction guides around prior authorization. They include the coverage requirements discovery, which is focused on enabling the exchange of coverage information within the provider workflow. So that it answers the important first question of, do I need a prior authorization? Because if we can answer that quickly and let them know that there's not, they can continue delivering patient care. And if there is a requirement for prior authorization, it's known early so that it can be addressed in order to prevent delays in patient care and decision-making. The second guide, documentation, templates, and rules can be driven both by itself, but typically would be launched through a response of the coverage requirements discovery. When we know that we need documentation, allows the provider to launch a Smart on Fire application to gather the information necessary to support the prior authorization or just the documentation requirements if it's required for post-payment review or other kind of administrative purposes. The key there is that the documentation templates and rules allows for us to use Smart on Fire, which is part of ONC certification. It allows us to predefine for the provider the documentation requirements that are needed in order to support prior authorization, and then utilize the functionality that Fire enables for us to gather that information automatically, the structured information from the EHR, and then present it to the provider and minimize the burden of having to gather data manually. And then as the provider can find that information and see what may be missing, we can try to address any missing information or necessary information, ideally at the time of while the patient's there. But if we have to schedule additional studies and tests, that can be done immediately too, in order to, again, prevent the delay in patient care delivery. And then finally, with that information gathered, we can then store it and then also forward that information as part of the prior authorization support implementation guide directly to the payer, and utilizing both FHIR as well as the HIPAA 278 transaction in order to get a ideally real-time or at least near real-time response so that we can continue on the process of delivering care. These three guides were named in the 2020 proposed rule 9123P, and we anticipate, based on the unified agenda, that CMS will be re-releasing some additional regulatory guidance around these guides this year. So it's important that we take the opportunity, as we have, to update the guides to make sure that any gaps that we have identified over the course of the last year or so get addressed, and then go back out for community feedback. So next slide, please. So the next three slides are going to build on themselves in order to kind of provide the a little context. The coverage requirements discovery utilizes a FHIR technology called CDS hooks, and I'll be highlighting these in a set of summary slides in a little bit. But the idea with CDS hooks is that it allows for the EHR to initiate clinical decision support services during the workflow. And the concept here is to allow the provider, when they go to order or review an order, like a referral or a request of some kind, it utilizes CDS hooks and the order details to reach out to a payer CDS service. And that payer CDS service takes that information around the patient, their coverage, what's being requested, and utilizing their business rules, respond with the answer of, yes, this either needs prior authorization, or no, it doesn't need prior authorization. That's encased within the CDS hooks. So this is functionality right now not required by EHR vendors, and is an important aspect of the prior authorization burden reduction IGs we're going to outline here. But also, I think it also, in my opinion as an informaticist, provides an opportunity to give a lot of information at the point of care for the right patient around their condition that's going to be very beneficial to patient care and minimizing burden for providers. So next slide. In the response of the CDS hooks from the payer, they can provide information that is in what we call a card. And that card is then displayed by the EHR. And in that card can be information about the procedure, the coverage details. It can link to information externally, like a web page. But most importantly, it allows for us to link to an application, a Smart on FHIR launch application, where we can put all the security parameters on so that we can then launch the application and display the documentation requirements for the provider. So this documentation requirements is based on a FHIR resource called Questionnaire and Questionnaire Response. And behind the scenes is another FHIR technology called the Clinical Quality Language. Together, that allows us to identify the data based on FHIR. Using CQL, we can provide some logic behind that. And using FHIR and the Smart on FHIR authorization authentication, we can retrieve that data programmatically. So a patient, if we had to order oxygen and the requirement was for a pulse oximetry, we can use the LOINC code that's embedded in the CQL or the questionnaire and automatically retrieve that and then display that for the provider. That's really beneficial because so much of prior authorization is gathering the right information that the payer would need to adjudicate the coverage and provide a authorization adjudication. So being able to do this programmatically using the structured data will save time for the provider. And then whatever is not in structured data or is missing can be highlighted for the provider so that that information can be addressed and labs or studies or other things can be ordered as well. The other thing that is very useful around the questionnaire is the ability to start using skip logic. So if the certain data is available, it may preclude the requirement of gathering additional data. So adding this additional logic, again, saves time and energy for the provider and make sure that the proper information is gathered for the payer. So next slide. So once this information is gathered and completed, we use the functionality outlined in the prior authorization support implementation guide that then packages that data, gathers the necessary information around X12 codes and such, so that we can package it and submit it as a FHIR operation to an endpoint. And that endpoint could be the payers, could be another vendor working with the payer or the provider, that then would translate that or transform that data into an X12 278 transaction. So we want to make sure we support the data elements from X12 that the payer would need in order to do their adjudication, as well as provide a mechanism for attaching the data, the clinical data, to the transaction in order to send it over to the payer. This was done because the current HIPAA requirements around the 278, but we also want to note that the Da Vinci project received an exception from CMS in order to pilot the use of a pure FHIR to FHIR approach to this transaction, but it would still be based on the kind of foundational work that X12 has done around the transaction coding. So this provides us the opportunity to submit the prior authorization using FHIR and doing real-time transactions, as well as the ability to query if the adjudication and the response is not an immediate response from the provider, from the payer. So this allows for the kind of polling that is helpful to the providers, because today many of them have to monitor, communicate, and do a lot of work through multiple different payer portals, which can again be a burden to the providers. So we think that this whole approach provides an improvement in the current work of doing prior authorizations, putting it into workflow, making sure that we answer the important questions around coverage needs, and making sure that data is collected appropriately to support the prior authorization. So next slide. So this is just another kind of workflow description, using an example of durable medical equipment, where we link the CDS hooks process, the response from the payer using a library of coverage rules and templates, and then responding with CDS hooks, and then launching the Smart on FHIR app if additional information is necessary. So it really does take the guesswork out of some very specific patient coverage information that most providers wouldn't know. You know, often providers know about, generally about patients' coverage, but they may not have the specifics, and often wouldn't know whether or not the prior auth was required for a given order or request. So next slide. So in the next three slides, I just want to highlight some core or base FHIR technologies that are identified in these guides. It's not a complete list, because the ideally you would go to the implementation guides to find all these details. But I think this can help the task force to identify opportunities for testing and certification. We test all these components during our Connectathon and our testing events. So there are already opportunities to do this testing for FHIR conformance. And so these may additionally be opportunities to do testing for certification. For the coverage requirements discovery, as I mentioned, we use CDS hooks. So in order to do that, we need the ability for EHRs to be able to trigger CDS hooks at the appropriate time, such as for order select or order sign. We have to have the ability for payers to have CDS services to respond to these requests and properly match the patient and their coverage and what's being ordered in order to provide that response. And from the CDS hooks specification, the ability to provide a smart launch context or a link inside those cards so that the provider can launch that Smart on FHIR app. The CDS or the CRD IG leverages the FHIR US core, a number of profiled resources, including patient, provider, and counter. We utilize the coverage to make sure we have the right patient, the right coverage. And then we utilize the device request and number of request resources to exchange the details of the device, medication, or nutrition order that is being requested. It also builds upon the current US core profiles and terminologies, including the service request kind of codes that we need today for around CBT, we use Snowman, HCPCS, and MOINC. So these each of these are opportunities that we can use to currently test, but maybe good for consideration for certification testing. Next slide, please. In order to support documentation templates and rules, we need a number of core fire technologies. We have the Smart on Fire app launch and the security like OAuth 2 associated with that. That's already in ONC's certification plans. We need to be able to support CDS hooks, as I mentioned before. We need to be able to do structured data capture, which is part of the questionnaire and the questionnaire response. So that allows us to make sure that we structure these questionnaires in a way that is standardized for not only the app, but in the future, if EHRs wanted to kind of adopt these technologies within their own EHRs, we want to be able to have that. And then CQL, or clinical quality language, which allows us to put in those rules, the rules both around what's required and then how to retrieve that information, as well as the adjudication rules can be supported by CQL. And an easy example is a patient who a provider wants to order oxygen. The payer may require that a room air oxygen saturation is below 88, and we can retrieve that with a specific LOINC code or lab code, and then take the value and then use that value as part of the CQL calculations to say we met one or more of the criteria. So the CQL is a really powerful language, and it's leveraged in other fire implementation guides, including the work around quality measures. We'd also, again, want to be able to support US Corps, which is already well underway, but also that this questionnaire and questionnaire response, as well as this task resource, which is also relatively new, but it has been proven out in our Connectathon testing, where you can create tasks and assign it to others. And this was put in because we recognize that there are times when all the data may not be available and we have to do a handoff in order to order additional tests and studies, get them done, and make sure that the prior authorization is readdressed when the data is available then. And this is going to be used later on in one of our other guides as well. And then next slide, please. For the prior authorization support, we are leveraging two fire operations, this ability to submit the a fire claim resource with all the X12 information, as well as the clinical information that was gathered, and then the ability for providers to do a query on that prior authorization. I know it says claim, but claim is more about the fire terminology, but really it's a submission for a prior authorization. And in the bundle of information, it includes this beneficiary information, the codes necessary for the payers, as well as the coverage information and what's being requested. And we leverage the existing X12 code sets, some codes from the AHA. Of course, these we get permission to do testing on them, but we expect that implementers would follow any required licensing agreements to use these codes in production. We've had really great cooperation from X12 to allow us to point the developers to a set of X12 resources in order to do testing. So we appreciate that collaboration. So next slide, please. So those are the three that are around burden reduction. I just wanted to highlight in the little bit of time I have left, our additional implementation guide called the Clinical Data Exchange. This guide is going to be published at the end of this quarter, but really we want to highlight its ability to be to facilitate and automate the processes for both payer to provider, as well as for provider to provider clinical data exchange. Workflows can include like referrals, adding attachments to claim submissions, documenting information for post-payment review or claims audits, and then using it for supplemental data for other workflows, including prior auth, risk adjustment and quality measures. We call this supplemental data because each of these guides, just like the prior auth I just described, already have a method for collecting data, but there will be times, hopefully very rarely, that additional data will be requested by the payer. And using this clinical data exchange methodology, they can request that in a programmatic predefined way, saying that I need a certain lab, I need a certain document or clinical note. And then it allows the payer and provider, depending on their relationship, to either create tasks for the provider to retrieve this information and allow the provider to review it. Or as we have seen in some of our, Da Vinci members have a very close working relationship with their payers, and in their contracts allow payers to directly query their EHRs in order to get this information. The key here is that it's this balance between being able to identify the data you need in advance, using FHIR to automate the query and collection of that data, and allow the payer and provider, depending on the level of their contracts and relationships, to either do it in a way that requires minimal human review all the way to totally direct queries. And so anything that's available in FHIR today, it's supported by the EHR, can be retrieved through this IG. So next slide. I didn't want to give you all words, so we put in a little graphic to show that we can initiate requests from a system, either a provider or a payer. The request goes into the EHR of the receiving provider, the data provider, and then can be either done automatically, depending on the relationship, or can be reviewed in advance. We think that this is also a great opportunity for us to improve the data sharing from for clinicians when referrals are made. We had a call with our clinical advisory committee, and that came out as a really big value for them, because that is a direct way we can use data to improve patient care and again, prevent the delay in clinical decision-making awaiting data. So next slide, please. Some of the key technologies that are part of CDEX, the core FHIR RESTful queries that are available today is really at the core of this when you want to do direct, but also the ability to do tasks and subscriptions when you want to both define the request as well as give the request receiver the opportunity to review them. We have the ability to do polling of this task so that the requester can know the status of the progress of the request. And then the data provider can then provide respond to these requests and return to the requesting group. So these are really useful. We can also create, we've created the submit attachment operation in order to create these bundles of information as well. We've also support, and it's noted in the RFI, the ability to do signatures in the data content, and we're leveraging the core FHIR guidance around that. And we've added a number of value sets based on requests from the community and the providers around understanding the purpose of the data request, the reason for the attachments, and then provide work queues to monitor these requests. So next slide, please. So just to highlight things that are happening in the rest of this year, we have our burden reduction. These three guys are going back in as an early ballot to HL7. It'll be starting in the next few weeks as we're putting together all our ballot content. We've done this because these are pretty significant implementation guides, and we wanted to balance the work that we're asking the HL7 community and the broader community between the January ballot and a large FHIR R5 ballot happening in May. So we're hoping that by putting it in at this time, they'll be able to give it the thorough review that we hope to have to make it better. We hope to then to take the ballot comments and do what we call reconciliation, addressing the concerns or questions and comments from the ballot. And then ideally, aspirationally, we want to have this published by Q4 of this year. For the clinical data exchange, We anticipate it will be published at the end of this quarter or early the next quarter at the latest. But of course, we want to have ongoing testing and feedback of what's in that guide, as well as we are publishing this guide with some draft content. It's not part of the STU, but we highlighted this because this came out of the initial ballot reconciliation of content, such as doing unsolicited push for, say, the claims or for referrals. We wanted to make sure we had guidance out there so that the community could pick it up, start to do some testing around it, so that when we go take CDEX back to the next STU update, we will have had a good amount of testing on these draft content. So last slide. I put a link to a number of these implementation guides for the task force, as well as for the community to find it more easily. So we welcome feedback. If you see anything that you have concerns about when you look at these, every fire specification webpage has a link at the bottom for providing feedback. So we believe in kind of constant and continuous improvement. So please give us feedback if things are unclear or are you having issues with any of our guides. And then our last slide is just some contact information. Feel free to reach out to me or to Jocelyn Keegan or Vanessa Candelora from our program management. We look forward to answering questions and if necessary, come back and elaborate on some of these ideas if you'd like. I was able to stay on time.
You are great, Viet. Thank you for being so concise. And we have a bunch of questions for you, if you don't mind me just firing them away. And if I ask your question and there needs clarification, please feel free to jump on. They're all in the chat, Viet, if you need a little bit more context, just to get the time moving with our limited time here. But I wanted to start with a question from Hans. One of the points that we've really been pondering on is, you know, the perception in a lot of these presentations is all this happens in the EHR. And in fact, in the provider or hospital setting, it could be an external administrative system, it could be a RCM or a PMS, it could be an app, you know, so it's not such a clear workflow, but it's easier to discuss it as one, you know, software package does this all. So with that context, let me just ask the question that Hans laid out. The slides imply that EHR back office systems directly interact with a payer. They do not indicate how this would flow with a smart app, and intermediaries may fulfill certain capabilities, thus yielding a different configuration of interactions between EHR and payers. Additionally, on the provider side, multiple HIT beyond the EHR is likely involved for the back office systems from different HIT suppliers. How do you propose that we get the clarity to avoid certification to take too much of a monolithic or a one model approach rather than enabling a more flexible configuration approach to meet the configurations where they're at today?
Yes, we definitely recognize that as a terminologist, I would say EHR, saying EHR is a little bit ambiguous because we know that there are EHRs that have revenue cycle management components that are integrally connected to their clinical systems, and there are others that are not. I would say, to the extent that we don't have a specific recommendation yet, I think there will be that we will need at least terminology modules within the EHR component that supports the ability to send and receive these X12 or CPT codes in order for the payers to receive the codes that they need in order to do the initial coverage determinations, as well as to be able to provide the codes needed in the prior authorization support transactions, the submit transactions to support the prior auth. So I think there is going to, we're going to have to provide some additional guidance around that. And it's been a little challenging because of the differences in these configurations. We were able to at least identify how this would work in a transaction, in a provider workflow, and be able to identify the data elements that we needed for the X12 transaction support.
Hans, did you want to expand on that question?
Sure, just a little bit. and that is that perhaps one of the steps that the IGs can look at, and that might not be sufficient, but within the IGs, better recognize the boundaries between these interactions that could be spread across and be between these different components. So it becomes easier from a certification perspective or otherwise to point to that specifically, and you know what's expected or not in that context. Up to date, the IGs have been working well to get projects going because the participants had a good idea what they needed to pull from each IG to make a particular interaction work. But if we are in a certification mode, it needs to be much more specific and clear what they are. So I'd suggest that that as part of this ballot cycle in some fashion, that's being addressed as well to have that. And the other part is that just to clarify, there may be systems that are that have the ability to have combined EHRs and rev cycle and HIM and et cetera, all those components. That still does not mean that the provider has all those components from the same supplier. There are plenty of providers that, yes, they could have had everything from one, quote unquote, but they have opted not to because they have a revenue cycle from one, the clinical from another, HIM, somewhere else. There's all kinds of different variations there that are out there. So we should not only look at what is being offered, we need to look at what's out there. And then based on that, say, what are some realistic boundaries where these interactions need to cross HIT? And because we are thinking certification, we need to formalize that more than what we needed to date, because the community had a pretty good idea what they were expected to do or not, and from there. So,
thank you. I'll take that feedback back to the team. And in one way for us to help the community can help us is to bring your configurations and your challenges to us. We've had really good participation from the larger EHRs. But for those who, as you described, have primarily clinical data and not necessarily the revenue cycle components, come to our testing events and our connectathons, because we need that feedback in order to improve these guides.
Okay, and a next question is in regards to the FHIR questionnaire. We're looking at non-provider workflows versus, you know, the clinician workflows. So can you address delegating the FHIR questionnaire completion from clinician to other practice staff and or putting in the work queue to store initiated PA requests for later completion? Does the guides address that type of role-based workflow?
Yes, we're working on that and actually working with the EHR vendors around that, because we need to be able to understand how they manage work queues and the general term we've been using around delegation, because in the ideal happy path, all the information is there and we can complete the documentation template and rules, but we know that sometimes it's not there. And so being able to delegate hand off the gathering of additional information or handing off to complete another task to generate data is going to be important.
Another question is, as we talk about these IGs balloting, there are also some production implementation of these approaches.
Yes, and actually maybe my colleague Jocelyn can send up a link. We had a really great presentation from our members back in January in our community roundtable, where they demonstrated how they put these guides into production to demonstrate this. I think that may have been the crux of the question, because we always have the question is, where is this happening? And is it real? And so having our members bringing their production level demonstrations to the community is the way we try to respond to that. So we have monthly community roundtables to highlight the efforts of our members and others to implement our guides in the real world.
And then another one is in regards to, certification requirements for EMRs to support CDS hooks and CQL. Could it eliminate the need for EMR vendors to support multiple Smart on FHIR apps for every payer UM vendor? they thought that this might be an issue for the model of needing the Smart on Fire app to mediate between the guides and the EMR provider workflow.
I think that is a potential. I don't know if I would say it would eliminate. Those are fairly strong and stark words. So I think it would certainly facilitate the ability for EHRs to do the functionality that is embedded inside a Smart on Fire.
Tammy, we have a couple people with their hand raised.
Okay, I was just trying to get through the questions in the chat first, and then we'll get the raised hands. Just because for time, it's just kind of quicker to get through these. DTR does not clearly address how a smart app would gather the data from the source system. There has been general consensus that Fire US Core would be a starting point beyond which various other techniques can be deployed until Fire US Core incorporates that data. The source system need not, Hans, you got a lot of words here, need not support CQL or questionnaire responses, rather have Fire US Core-based API available to enable the smart app to gather the data. Will that be clarified in an upcoming version?
Well, US Core is already built into the expected functionality of the EHRs, and with the smart, assuming the scopes of the Smart on Fire app allows, say, a provider scope, which is very broad, we should be able to do standardized US Core queries and the terminology and codes that are inherent in like observations or medications or allergies, things like that. We should be able to retrieve them using US Core. So that's part of the Smart on Fire functionality. It's the fire part of the Smart on Fire functionality, for those who are not familiar.
If the system is certified, you can expect that Fire's use course there. If not certified, the guidance might be helpful because they might not have it.
Fair, yes.
Okay, and then two questions about the supplemental data. One is, we've been trying to come up with what is their use cases when supplemental data would be used, is the first part of that question. And the second is a clarification question about CDS is not meant for use within DTR to gather the relevant data, rather for supplemental data, where the initial data set turns out to be incomplete. So could you kind of address those two together?
Sure. So the DTR and the FHIR questionnaire and the CQL information sent over by the payer that defines their data needs are things that you would expect the payer to know in advance that they need. That may work very well when we have really good structured requirements around coverage, but we recognize that that's even the happy path, and that's the 80% or more. There are going to be times when payers may need additional clarifying data that during their adjudication. Always, the happy path is good structured data, well-articulated adjudication rules, and a real-time or near real-time response. But the real world is they may need more data. And by using CDEX, it allows the payer to define that data that they need as FHIR queries and inside a communication request or a task. And it's those FHIR queries that can be reviewed by the provider, and then ideally, they press approve and FHIR in the background retrieves all that information, as opposed to having them do a task list of retrieve the labs, retrieve the medications, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the ability for using CDEX to gather additional data. That additional data may be, say, for that risk adjustment. Right now, our risk adjustment implementation guide is really focused on identifying the list of patients that where they're maybe historical or suspected conditions, but it doesn't currently, because CMS doesn't take in FHIR data per se for risk data, payers need that clinical data to provide evidence is probably too strong a word, but supporting data for when they do risk adjusted payments. So that's the opportunity to use CDEX to gather supplemental data. And for quality measures in the paradigm of fire, the data requirements to support them and the algorithms are built into the quality measure themselves, into the CQL and using fire. But there may be times where there's additional data needed to support a given quality measure for, say, auditing or a HEDIS review or some other activity. And so CDEX, again, can be akin to what we are asking payers to do today, which is to go into DHR and do screenshots or do things that are very manual. We'd like to be able to do that in an automated way.
Okay, the next question is, how scalable is this model? Would CDX allow for exchange to HIEs, QHINs, et cetera, for the more complete view of the clinical data to support the pre-authorizations? Or is it limited to payer provider?
Well, prior authorization is certainly payer provider that in that relationship. I think the QHINs definitely have an approach that they could support. I mean, it depends on whether or not a system wants to do federated or centralized, the role of the HIEs in providing patient kind of engagement in their data. So that I think we'd have to answer that by asking about specific
case.
Yeah, I'm always hesitant to do broad statements if I don't have a specific workflow that I can apply a technology to. And that's kind of the core of what we do. If you have a good workflow, we can evaluate it.
Yeah. Now, another person is saying, based on the timeline slide, is it fair to say that these guides are in flux until best case scenario end of this year? And then add on, you know, you said it's in the growth maturity stage. Kind of where do you feel these guides are at in regards to maturity?
So the CDEX guide is being implemented today by members. The published content is ready to be picked up and put into production and pilots. The draft content we think can work because a lot of it is already based on core fire technologies. But we also want to do, you know, more testing in a variety of those packages, those lists of the data requests. We wanted to elaborate that more. For the burn reduction, it's all, again, already having our members and others putting these into production. What we've added in response to things that we've heard in either ballot reconciliation or just things that have come up from the original NPRM. So I don't want people to have the impression that these are all new. They're incremental improvements on the guides themselves. So they are constantly maturing, but they're constantly maturing in a way like an athlete matures their way to, you know, go into the pros, if I can use a metaphor. So we want folks to help us expedite the maturation by doing those implementations and coming to testing events and giving us feedback.
Sorry for this rapid fire questioning. This will help us when we have our conversations. Rich, you had a question, then we'll do Heather and Eli, and then we're gonna have to close it so that we can continue our task force discussion on this topic. Rich?
Yeah, thanks. Great presentation, very informative. One comment and one question. The comment is that everything's Hans Bautendijk said about the complexity of the multiple systems that providers deal with also apply on the payer side, in combination of in-house and external business associate vendor systems there as well. The question is, given the testing that's been done, do you have any real, staying very high level, any preliminary results? And are there any particular categories of prior auth that are working better than other categories?
Yes, I would say that where the data is well structured and supported by US Core so that they can be retrieved, and where the testers and the vendors who come and have maturity around CQL can use that data to do adjudication, both the vendors and the payers, those are going to go more smoothly. And so there's a fair amount of knowledge work to be done when it comes to taking what has been historically human readable beneficiary rules and making them more and more automated using CQL. So I think we have very, very promising work and good early pilots from our members. As I mentioned, you can see more at the community roundtable recording. So I'm very optimistic. I wouldn't say that we can do all prior auth now. I think that's hard to be able to say, but over time we'll be able to do more and more. And not necessarily the goal of this IG, but as payers and providers are sharing more and more of this clinical data, and we use this automated method and can be able to track the successes or where the algorithms break down, we can start looking at, you know, AI and machine learning and improve in the ability to prior auth from both right now of this very algorithmic deterministic approach to more of an AI approach that takes into account the provider history and the patient history and additional clinical data. So that's where I think some of the promise for the future will be around this.
Thanks.
Heather?
Thanks so much. And thanks so much, Viet, for being here today. This has been super helpful. And I appreciate kind of the new information you added about the kind of the metrics on the maturity of the guides. That's really helpful. I hadn't seen that before. I wanted to kind of loop back to the idea of the kind of delegation to other practice staff, because I want to be honest, sometimes, you know, we start talking to physicians who are not familiar with the guides at all, and they hear about this and they're like, oh, it's going to tell me in my EHR that prior auth is required and when I need, you know, what information I need. That's great. But then they start getting anxious, like, oh, you mean I have to do this all right now when the patient's still there? I can't give it to my staff like I'm doing today. I mean, we certainly don't want to go to a situation where physicians are actually doing more of this administrative work than they are right now. That's kind of a horror story, and there's some real angst around that. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit more in terms of where the guides are right now about that delegation capacity. And I know there's been a lot of discussion about this in some of the Da Vinci work groups of late, and particularly this idea of how you store a request for later, and this idea, this concept of transient data, and is it going to be stored with the payer, which is really concerning from a provider, and I would think from a patient perspective, because this isn't actually a full-blown prior auth request yet. You know, is that going to be stored in the EHR system? My understanding is EHRs aren't able to do that yet. So just understanding this really important ability to delegate to kind of match the way things work in the practice setting now, and how close these guides are right now to be able to do that to match the way things work today in a physician practice.
Yeah, I think I would say that this is the ongoing work that we need to have the EHR vendors at the table. Because I think we can do it from the interoperability side and define how we would do it if we were in what I call kind of an all fire all the time approach. But we recognize we're working with existing technology and needing to do these things that we can represent and fire in a real world EHR. So I would say that we know that there's the need around delegation. And we have a framework that we need to do more testing, and we need the EHR vendors to kind of work with us. And they have been, a number of them have been, but the more we can have more participation, the better. But the other thing I do want to address clearly is around the clinician burden. I, having been a practicing physician, I do recognize that there is an additional ask when we want clinicians to kind of review their documentation requirements. But the hopefully very small amount of additional ask in their time in front of the patient will ideally save what has become hours of additional work that they do in what we've traditionally called the pajama time, or the documenting after the hours, where they get a knock on the door and says, Dr. Nguyen, you saw this patient today, asked for a prior auth, and you didn't get their, they didn't have an oxygen saturation. We got to get them, bring them back into the office. We got to do that. We got to document before we can submit this prior authorization. So there may be a hopefully very small additional time to make sure that the documentation is there. We would definitely benefit from the support of the staff to make sure that documentation is complete. And that goes to the delegation parts. But the goal is really to reduce the overall burden on the provider office and ultimately reduce the delay in care delivery for the patient.
And Viet, just to wrap it up here, and I know we'll be sending you questions, and I know you have some other stuff to expand here, but the last question is in regards to the CDEX IG. There's also some questions in the RFI in regards to attachments. Could you expand at all on how CDEX IG could support attachments and if there's any alternative approaches, just kind of give us any guidance in that piece?
Yes, we think CDEX could be a very viable approach to providing clinical data as attachments. And again, as a terminologist, I think we make the distinction between a capital A attachments and HIPAA transactions and attaching clinical data to support workflows. And so we have identified a number of opportunities within the CDEX, and I listed them in the slides around referrals, adding a FHIR bundle as an attachment to a claim. And the benefit there is that that data is well-structured in FHIR. It can be retrieved programmatically using FHIR queries, just like we would in a post-payment review kind of request, and would make it so that the payer, when they receive that data, can use it as pure FHIR resources. So they can evaluate and use the codified components of it. They can ingest it really quickly. So there's a lot of benefits in using the CDEX approach for a number of what would be kind of workflows and needs from the capital A attachments transactions.
And that's for internal and external to the EHR, whether it be reside in an external database, Smart on FHIR.
There would be places to assemble it using Smart on FHIR or using it, creating programmatic views. So let's say you had a hospital discharge for a particular condition, and payers can define that almost all the time we ask for 1 through 10 data elements when we do post-payment review. Let's get them to define those in advance and then have that agreed by the providers and say that when they get a post-payment review, here's what we would expect. It's easier for the payer because then they can pull it off the shelf, a list of a package of data that they need for a particular purpose. And the providers would know in advance that this is data that is often requested and they can support in their systems.
Thank you again, Viet, and thanks for putting us all in a compressed time frame and taking this rapid fire questioning. But again, we're just trying to maximize our use of our time. And we definitely will be reaching out. And thanks also to your partner there, Jocelyn, for her clarifications as well. So I'll let you go. And please stay on in case, there's any additional points you wish to make. While I transition to the Google Doc and bring up section 2, David DeGardi, do you mind introducing yourself?
Sure, Dave DeGandy, I'm Cambie Health Solutions. That presentation at the community roundtable that Viet was referring to was part of that presentation along with MCG. We have Raj on the phone for that too. We developed that Smart on FHIR solution with our provider partners, MultiCare and OHSU. Some Northwest providers here out here in the Northwest. So we're pushing the needle on pre-auth.
Excellent. Thank you, David, and apologize for mispronouncing your last name there. Right. I should know better by now. All right. So our call goals now, we only have 20 minutes. So I really, really want to ask all of you to go to the Google Docs. Because we did get some revised language assignments, and Raj and Jim did a great job reviewing the attachments. And I also took the functional criteria and put it in kind of a workflow order. And we'll get back to that conversation, but really need your comments or agreement with what's there in Google Docs over the week. But right now, let's go through discussion questions 2.1 and 2.7. I pulled the comments that were already in the Google Docs, and we're kind of over the board. But the first question, really want to discuss, what do you think the current readiness is for CRD, DTR, and PAS? And I know a lot of you are working with DaVinci, so we do have a lot of expertise on this panel. For adoption as part of the certification criteria, feasible timeline, and if additional changes are needed. The current comments range from, I think everybody agreed that they're not ready for adoption and more real world testing is needed, and that this is a key area that needs continued monitoring. But the timeline, we were kind of over the board from 2 years piloting and continued to reintegrate the implementation guides. And then the other was 1 year, and the other was there just needs to be more adoption. So anybody have any comments on what is listed there? And let me get. I lost you guys here, just a second.
So Tammy, it's Patrick.
Oh, thank you, Patrick. I lost the hands.
No, you're good. I think IG is not ready for adoption. That's a kind of a fairly strong statement. Some of these, I think, for example, like DTR, there already are implementations. So I'm not saying that we don't need additional testing or additional real world validation, but the blanket statement that they're not ready for adoption is just a little bit concerning to me.
Anybody else have any other comments or?
Raj has a comment.
Thank you, Cheryl. I don't know how to get.
I'll call
oh,
the
here it is.
Leah Hans.
Thank you.
And then Heather. Go ahead, Raj.
I agree with Patrick. I think that's a pretty strong statement. I think I warn all the committee, when we look at the implementation guides and the scope of prior art, they will never be ready for industry. I mean, even probably 5 years from now. The way we have to approach this is, when you think about the whole workflow, what are the pieces that would add value? Like, you know, what is the minimum viable product? What are the pieces that in the CRD and DTR that would help? As an example, can the IG helps us to answer, is prior auth required? And if that one question is being answered, that would reduce the burden for the provider to some extent. Right, a lot of times they ask these things unknowingly and spending a lot of hours. The other piece of that is, can we find the status of the prior auth and share with the members? Right, that would reduce the anxiety for the member. What happened to my request? So we have to take a granular approach where there is already a maturity and reduced reduction of burden and the value. And then we have to allow for the maturity where other functional workflows will grow. So that is true for any use case, but even for this one, given the magnitude of this use case, we just have to be careful when we make the strong statements, right? Because there is value in a lot of pieces that's already in production.
And remember, I need help with what type of response, consensus response we want to move toward.
All right, we have a couple more hands raised, but I think we're going to have to provide some gradation to the response and not have it be, you know, all or nothing, because I think what everyone is saying is that there are different levels of maturity for each of the implementation guides. And some of them have been implemented like CRD for certain purposes. This is a different use. So there is going to have to be learning to occur because of this different use. But let's go to Hans. I see a lot of nodding heads. So I think I paraphrased it correctly. Go ahead, Hans.
Yeah, and I think it's that I would agree. It's not a blanket statement. There is variation in them. I'm looking at the chat and Rich's last comment. I would agree with that. It's probably more at the overall. But I also think is that if you look back and you look at the parties that have participated in it, in the development, in the journey to get there, it is very ready to be used and to find the boundaries where things need to be among that group that has been so deeply ingrained with it to date. But we are now looking at how can it be used for certification, which is a different world. having gone through that for the last 10, 12 years under meaningful use, promoting interoperability and whatnot. So that it's a different way of looking at it, because now it is a part of, is the requirement unambiguous? And can I have good testing and validation against it? But because in some ways it's a pass-fail. It's not a we work it out and we'll find the boundaries and we work with that. And in the latter regard, the guides are a great start, sufficiently mature to get people on a path. For certification, I think they are not fully ready. And the minimum that's, and you added it there, is that we need to do a little bit more work to understand in that variety of configurations, certainly on the provider side, and Rich Landon also identified on the payer side, there are these variations that we are in need of looking more at the interaction levels because they could be separated across different HIT rather than the the IGs as an individual one, the three, or even as the big three and says that you must support all three or you must support either one of them or you can have all of them and have some optionality. The IG level today would not be sufficiently granular to unambiguously understand what am I expected and what's the combination of things that I must have at a minimum to make the EPA flow properly, recognizing that not everything, even though it could be, not everything is going to be part of a singular HIT solution. That's just not going to happen in the beginning across the board. There might be some, and there will be some others that don't because that's not where they're at.
Okay, I know we're going to get into the modular questions again, and Hans, that totally makes sense. Since I think we're all pretty much saying the same thing, I'm going to be putting this in the Google Docs for you guys to comment on in regards to the readiness question. And then if we could go to the timeline, one of them just said that you can't really mention what the timeline can be. We need the more testing, or is anybody... want to put a stake in the ground that we should address, timeline with funding. One was 2 to 3 years testing and piloting. Any comments on that piece?
Heather has her hand raised.
Oh, sorry, Heather.
Let's get her in.
Yeah, just kind of picking up the thread that Cheryl raised earlier that, you know, just a strict black and no on all this, I think is hard. But I think that, I mean, hopefully we can take the approach. I realize this task force has a limited time frame to it, but, you know, forcing ourselves into a box of saying, yes, no, this timeline right now might be premature. I mean, from what Viet just said, you know, the guides might be very different this time next year, and we might be in a better position to make a recommendation on any of this, particularly related to timeline. So I'm wondering if there's a way to kind of say things are in flux right now, but we can continue to evaluate this and urge, everyone to take another look at this in a year's time or whatever, when the guides have been through the ballot reconciliation process. And also picking up just the point that Hans was just making that, from certification perspective, these guides, production standpoint, the guides are, you know, ready to be used and tested and such, but that's very different than certification. We have to remember that when we're talking about adopting the guides for certification, we're saying that, you know, practices that, you know, want to participate in government payment programs are going to have this technology. And that's a pretty big thing to put on providers when there's obviously so many things, so much in flux right now, and so many questions about the functionalities of the guides.
Good point. I will drop these three timelines in the Google Docs. It sounds like the third timeline, just based on the conversation. Raj, did you want to speak to the timeline or?
Yeah. Okay. I'll make a quick comment. I think—
No worries.
Yeah, the timeline should be around what is ready and what provides value, right? So it is tied to the first comment we made that, you know, it is not ready for adoption at scale, but the pieces that are ready, that provides value. We always have to look at what's the value to the providers and the members, and then put the timeline around those pieces and then allow maturity for others.
Now, can you, do you feel comfortable taking those IGs and put signing a timeline to them?
Yeah, anybody would like to be part of that, I'd be happy to take a shot at that.
Yeah, and then
Raj,
if we can
I'd like to partner up with that.
And I don't want to throw a wrench into it, but I do want to at least say this, and maybe we need to speak to it at some point. But the adoption and the timelines also need to be relative to the scope of what is going to be required. Exactly. And we've already heard that there may be some complex situations which are not going to be ready day one. So I don't know the best way to express the scope, but I do think in answer to this question, we need to provide some context of scope.
Exactly. Yeah, I totally understand.
Okay, perfect. Good point. Okay, so we'll hold this one to go back after we determine the minimized functional criteria. Okay, number two, IGs are not ready. Should ONC still propose certification? While there was agreement, this is a high priority to continue and monitor and evaluate. It was split on adding criteria and timing. The most thought that it should be proposed. And you can read these comments. I won't go through it. And there was one do not add. Anybody want to speak to this?
Is there a time frame that the certification would be enforced or in place? I mean, can it be staged where more complexity further down the line in future?
Yes. We could propose to that, you know, it not be mandatory and it just be forward visioning. This is where the certification is going so that it can help those innovative vendors plan for the future. Is that kind of where you're going?
Because, the IGs lay out a path to full automation, which is going to take a long time and a lot of steps to get there, a lot of functionality in different areas. And taking an incremental approach will allow us to complete that full automation dream.
Yeah, we have to have some level of ONC guidance on these things. Otherwise, EMRs won't adopt.
Right, so right.
Like a chicken and egg problem we have to solve.
Right, I'm saying, and is an option to do an iterative certification tightening. Okay, cool.
Yeah, I think that's the way to frame it. And again, I don't know the right wording, but I do think it should be iterative. And I do think there should be a stake in the ground around a timeline. Otherwise, we won't get the EHR systems to adopt it. And really, the goal is if we have the standard, then more of us can adopt it and scale more quickly.
Right. Completely.
Yeah, a couple of reactions. To make it work, we need to have all the stakeholders in the EPA flow adopt sufficient to make it work. So I think we have to be careful to point to we want the EHRs to adopt it. We want the payers to adopt it. We want to have the right other systems adopt it so that the combination that it works. That's the ultimate goal that we have. The challenge that I see that I'm still struggling with on how to phrase it here is that if we don't have, there are different levels of certification criteria that can be there that can start with a functional required, and then the implementer, the developer of that capability can fill it out as they best see fit. And to the extent that you do that for something that the HRT supply can be relatively independent, that works, or with some additional perspective, we have flavors of that, where it partially works or otherwise, is that the APIs were initially in without technical specifications. Now they're in that everybody is working on against FHIR-R4 and US Core. So that's a two-step approach. So that can be done, but this is a complex workflow. So on the one hand, you say, so you really need to have the specificity in the IG so that you can figure that out. And in the absence of one singular monolithic approach, if you just put in a functional requirement, which part of the puzzle am I now obligated or aiming for or would like to fulfill to make sure that that piece, together with all the other pieces, makes it work? That's the part that I'm struggling with. And that's why I have not put in more comments than what I've done. So I'm not sure how to phrase that.
I don't think we're quite ready yet for the guides as they are, although they can be very rapidly there with that traditional guidance. But if you do it functionally, how do you know that I end up with an EPA workflow across the components that actually works? Now, I don't have the answer to that yet, and I'm not sure how to do that yet.
I thought there was a question tied to that, but I hear what you're saying. David?
Yeah, what's the scope of the certification requirements? Can we specify, say, in the other parties that Hans was referring to, or the payers, can we specify payer certification, or is it just EMR certification?
Okay, Alex, I may ask you to talk about the module versus individual, because I think that's going to be important here. But my understanding, this is a health IT certification, so it could be any software vendor would be under the umbrella. So the functional criteria could be housed in the EHR, it could be housed in a PMS, it could be housed in the FHIR app, but it would not be a payer certification. However, what we've created, David, is principles or prerequisites. The payer needs to disclose the prior auth requirement, right, in order to, you know, have that some of that automatic decisioning. So that's kind of where we've been putting the payer ask in this conversation for this report.
Okay. Recall though, Tammy, yep. One of the questions does ask if there should be payer certifications. And again, okay. I don't know how that would work because I'm not familiar enough with how the certification criteria apply today. But it's a good question. We'll have to just keep noodling on it.
Yeah, this is Alex. I would, support that the important to remember the health IT certification program is not specific to one type of vendor or one type of product, even though, of course, historically has mostly focused on EHR systems, but it is a tool that could be used to certify any type of product if that would be useful to advance interoperability. And I think, those are the questions in that final section of the RFI. Would certification be useful, for instance, on the payer end of this chain? Is that something that payers and the vendors they work with might make use of and be interested in? And then the secondary question, of if certification was directed to those other parties, may need to be changes in how that certification is designed to ensure it is relevant to those products.
Thank you. Hans, do you want to expand on your comment? I'm not sure how to ask that.
The thing is that the scope of ONC and CHRT certification, and Alex and others at ONC can correct, but at least our impression is that it covers HIT, but it has focused to date mostly on EHRs. But you see in the last one or two certification criteria rounds that it's opening up to HIT. So if we believe that EPA, the workflow, is supported by HIT to make that work, the question is then, if there are multiple HIT components across the workflow to make that work, aren't then all pieces HIT, and therefore all the actors that provide that HIT have the opportunity to participate in the certification program, recognizing that CHIT, becoming CHIT is a voluntary activity, although clearly based on the incentives put by CMS and others on it, there is a strong drive to have CHIT available. So I'm looking at that progression and says that, hey, if EPA is is supported by HIT, it's considered part of the HIT environment to make that happen. Before you know it, all the actors are in play, and therefore all could be eligible. Certainly they're all eligible if they want to, but it seems that opens the scope. But again, ONC, CMS need to further clarify it, and it may have to go back to the 2004 executive order that established ONC and their scope.
Yeah, I'll just, Hans, that's a very good point and important to remember that, you know, ONC's certification program is voluntary and that requirements by any parties to adopt certified technology are, you know, based on other policy mandates from other parts of HHS. So, you know, obviously the main EHR incentive programs have placed those requirements on payers. So another thing to think about in terms of certification for other parties is what other levers would be available to require use by those other parties, because that is would not come from the certification program.
That's a great point. I think we're going to move to public comment now.
That sounds great. And we're going to open up the call to the public if they'd like to make a comment. And if you are on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you happen to be on the phone only, you would press *9 to raise your hand. And once called upon, press *6 to mute and unmute your line. So we'll pause for a moment to see if any members of the public have a comment. And I see no hands raised, so we could resume. We'll leave the slide up for a moment in case anyone would like to make a comment. Thank you, Cheryl. Tammy?
Thank you so much. And then we have Heather with her hand raised on the prior subject. So Heather, go ahead.
Sure. Kind of getting back to the idea of payer certification, I'm wondering what folks' thoughts are the relationship of the CMS prior auth burden reduction NPRM that was out last year and it appears to be on the docket to be coming out again in the relatively near future, which would require payers to use these three implementation guides that we've been talking about for prior authorization. I mean, a certain set of payers at least, but I wonder, you know, what is the relationship between this RFI and theoretically an NPRM out there and theoretically in the near future that would require payers to adopt these guides? Because that would be a payer requirement. And are these two pieces of something bigger? I know this may be a intellectual question, but I think it's maybe something we should be thinking about. And is there a need for payer certification if there is this other piece out there that would be mandating payers to use the technology?
I think those are good questions, Heather. We had a couple people with their hands raised that would like to respond. Go ahead, Raj.
I think following up on Heather's point, I was wondering that if we could have CMS come and share their thoughts like we did today. That would be a good session to hear what they are thinking in terms of alignment.
Good point.
Good point. Patrick?
Yep, and just to kind of echo or amplify what Roger was saying is that these two on the ONC side for EHRs and on the CMS side for payers, they have to be in lockstep, right? Because if either side is out of balance, there's not reciprocity, and we're not going to the same implementation guides, the same interfaces, then we're creating a bigger problem than what we have today. We're back to one-off solutions, proprietary. So it's, from my perspective, it's absolutely critical, regardless of if payers have to be certified, that the regulations on both sides bring these two together for a solution, both from a payer perspective and from a provider perspective.
Yeah, I underline your comments. I absolutely agree. And then we have Dave from Cambia who would like to also weigh in.
Yes, comments similar to what Patrick was saying, where we certification would give us evidence that the APIs are compatible. You know, if that makes sense, where we know a payer is a certified payer will work with a certified EHR kind of connection thing, and so there is value in the payer certification if we want to go there.
Exactly. All right, so it looks like, Heather, you've got agreement from all of the commenters that, you know, having some sort of ability to come together and provide confirmation that we're all matching to the same requirements via certification or something would be helpful. Can we just pause one more moment and see if we have anyone with their hand raised for public comment?
I do not see any hands raised, Cheryl.
Okay. Why don't we go to wrap up then? Can we go to the next slide? Okay, so as we stated in the beginning, we do have an update for the HITECH meeting next week that the co-chairs and I and Excel and ONC will work on. And then we'll share that with you. So you'll have that as part of the materials for next week. There are homework assignments again. And Heather, I don't know if we need to assign some specifically. I'll leave that to you to highlight today. But our next meeting is on the 16th, which is a day earlier because of the HITECH meeting. And then we are looking next week to refine our recommendations, finalize our updates, and then, I have the date wrong. The HITECH update is the 17th. Of course, that's why we're changing the meeting. and then we did also include the links to the implementation guides that Viet went over today, so that those are there for you in the deck. And Tammy, do you want to add anything?
Yes. Just remember, you have the payer, provider, patient section assignments. We're going to be needing to have that completed in the next 2 weeks. But for next week, we have John Kelly coming, who's going to be speaking about the status of attachments from both CDA and fire-enabled attachments. So please look at section 3 and the questions relating to attachments and respond, those of you who are able, prior to that meeting in preparation. Also, I'm going to be posting, and Alex, hopefully you can help me, a document that gives Raj and Jim's recommendations for the functional criteria for attachments. And I put in a different document because I think it'll be easier to look at in workflow order. Your comments are needed on that document. The more we work outside of this meeting and can bring forward what appears to be consensus comments and discuss them, we'll be able to move quicker. So if you can keep your, go to Google Docs this week and spend a little bit of time, it'll really help us on this task force move forward. But I really appreciate your comments and thank again, Viet, for being on the call and look forward to hear from John next week from Weedy. Any questions? All right, then I think we can give everybody a couple minutes and have, so you now have a couple minutes to jump in that Google Docs and add some more comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Tammy. Slay Thanks driver. Everybody for your input and your conversation today.
Thank you.
Bye, thank you. Bye.